Welcome back to the second instalment of our deep dive into Free Radical and the legendary Time Splitters series. Today we'll discuss Time Splitters 2 and Time Splitters Future Perfect, reflecting on the progression of the series and the elements of the game that we are fond of. As our good friend Harry Tipper would say, let's go, spaceman, we got to boogie!
Hello, 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 everyone, and welcome back to the Missing Manual podcast. We're coming at you with our part two on one of the best games ever made, isn't that right, Zach?
Yes, welcome back, welcome back. Yeah, like I said today, Time Splitters 2, that's the first thing on the agenda.
Oh, Time Splitters 2, what a game.
Very excited.
What an unbelievable game. Yeah. We are looking at here one of potentially the best, well, the best shooters on the platform. I say the platform. This one actually was a bit more than just a PS1, wasn't it? A PS2, wasn't it? Because this one actually came out on Xbox and GameCube as well.
It did, yeah. All released in the fall of 2002. And it became the highest ranked first-person shooter for PlayStation 2 on GameRankings.com.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, it's such a big jump, and I think it speaks testaments to how well the first game really performed for the company, right? That the second game not only was a PlayStation title, but also was present on the Xbox and the GameCube, you know, so it covered every major console of that generation. You know, he had the trifecta, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like we said before, it was one of the standout titles. Not that it had a lot of steep competition on the, you know, the release
especially
of the PlayStation 2. But yeah, it was really refreshing to see that, that the success had transcended just beyond the one platform.
For sure. I think it started to definitely get that appeal, right? And I also think because so many people had PS2s, right, on release, that definitely helped salvage the franchise a bit more, didn't it?
Yeah, there are tons and tons of people that have got really, really good memories of the first game. And, you know, with the second one coming along, you know, fairly shortly after, it's only been sort of around 2 years after.
Mm, very, very quick, right?
Yeah, it's fresh in people's memory. And they're like, wow, you know, this first one was great. And this one just exceeds expectations. And it does everything that the first one did, but better.
So a little bit of quickfire history, obviously, as we spoke about in our first episode, it's made by Free Radical and also published by Eidos, correct?
Correct.
Correct. And ironically, I was looking online and reading a few interviews here and there with people who were at the company at the time. And it turns out that Time Splitters 2 wasn't actually going to be the next game that Free Radical made. They were actually going to make Second Sight before Time Splitters 2, which I found quite curious.
Okay.
They were actually meant to do Time Splitters 2. Second Sight. And in fact, Second Sight was originally what got them the deal with Eidos, the publishing deal. Time Splitters wasn't actually on the cards at all. Not even the first one.
Yes, yeah, it's quite interesting, really, considering that... Because it was... Who was it that published Second Sight? Was it also... we mentioned this in the last episode.
It was actually Codemasters that
it's
published
Codemasters,
Second Sight.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
And a lot of the developers, Steve Ellis and that lot, actually attribute that to the reason why Second Sight didn't do as well as it should have. Because it kind of switched publishers halfway through production, basically. And when it went over to Codemasters, he claimed that they didn't actually promote the game as well as they could have, which led to less sales.
It's a crying shame, really. There are so many good things that have fallen by the wayside due to poor marketing.
It is quite funny, actually, that Second Sight was originally the game that got them in the door, you know, not actually Time Splitters. Time Splitters was actually built, the original one and the second one, because of development costs of making a whole new game like Second Sight. And also it's because it's what the team knew, basically. They obviously drew on their experience from making GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, right? And they made Time Splitters. And they were going to Eidos with the intention to make Second Sight. They said it would take about 2 years to pull together, basically. And, you know, they didn't want to do that. So what they decided to do was to capture what they did in Time Splitters 1 and basically just expand on it on every way they could to make Time Splitters 2.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
I think it definitely worked out, right? I think they realized, right, that they had lightning in a bottle, didn't they? You know, they had captured lightning in the bottle when they made the first one. And I think that definitely was partly, you know, part of their thinking to want to go on to make the second game and not do Second Strike straight away.
Yeah, that's it. And the thing is that by following suit with a second installment, they learned from all the mistakes that they made in the first one. Exactly. And they were able to then put that into practice. Yeah, like you said, obviously, Second Sight, completely different kind of game, really.
100%,
isn't it?
Yeah, totally
you
different.
You can see that it's made by the same people, and there are certain similarities, but you're never going to get any closer than as a direct comparison than the sequel to a previous game, are you?
Exactly. And it's just what they knew, right? So, Timesplitters 2 started development pretty much instantly after the release of the first one, with the clear goal of expanding on what made number one so successful. Crucially, this game provided Timesplitters with a much needed story mode, I think, which was just not present at all in the first game, like we said last time, right?
Yeah, it was loose and kind of thrown together with that kind of arcade style.
It was just capture the bag, basically, in different places, wasn't it? Just go get the crystal, run to the exit.
Yeah, pretty much. So, I mean, with this one, all of the scenarios, even though they've managed to keep that dynamic flow of having every mission feel completely, you know, individual and unique, it is now tied together with an actual narrative. You have a main character, who's called Cortez, very, very, like, complete and utter copy of Vin Diesel's Riddick.
100%, yeah. he's a shameless copy.
Yeah. But he's done in such a way, you know, he's, especially in the second one, he's a lot more serious. They make him a little bit more comedic in the third one.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of, I think in the third one, what the third one does, we'll talk about that a little bit later, is it adds, like, obviously way more, it leans way more into the story, right?
Because, definitely.
Because 2 dips its feet in the story, which is what to expect, right? Considering the first game had no story. But the third one definitely goes straight through that wall, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it goes hard. It does, for sure.
You get a full-on story mode, like a full-on proper story, like you would in a modern game, right? Like a modern storyline.
Yeah, exactly that. Two still does have that kind of, like, significant barrier with the fact that you do... you are technically playing as Cortez, but every time he jumps through the time portal, he becomes another character. So there's still that definitive kind of, like, barricade in between each level that kind of pulls you out of it a little bit.
I think that's why maybe the development for Cortez only really kind of gets more in number 3, right? Because you actually play as him in every level, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Like,
whereas in this one, obviously, you just play as Cortez as someone else.
Yeah, and he's kind of, Cortez is used in this, in the second game, very much as kind of a center point, and then all of the other characters are kind of built in and around him. So he's kind of like the glue that holds the story together, but each level is still told from a character's perspective, per se, right? And every level has its own cutscene to start off with. So you get the kind of the flavor and the feel for the mission that you're about to play from that cutscene. And then you kind of just jump straight into it. So not really a lot of introduction, but like we've said, an awful lot more than you get in the first one.
And in total, there was a delicious 10 levels, wasn't there, in number 2?
Yes, there was, yeah.
So we have Siberia, we have Chicago, Notre Dame, Return to Planet X, a strong favourite of my one.
Yeah.
Neo Tokyo, which always makes me laugh because it's set in 2019.
Yeah.
The Wild West in 1853, Atom Smasher, Aztec Ruins, The Robot Factory, and finally The Space Station, where the storyline technically starts.
Yeah. So it's pretty good with the way that the campaign flows, because even though you've got those kind of breaks where you're playing as other characters, you come full circle and it all kind of ties in and you get your kind of the finish of the game playing as Cortez again. So you actually get to play as him, as himself, rather than playing as him, but as another character, if that makes sense.
Interestingly enough as well, Siberia, the very first level of the game, did you know half of the full dev time of the game was spent on that first mission?
Really?
It was indeed. Another interview I saw, so this is kind of interesting. So the game had 23 months dev time in total, took 23 months to create Timesplitters 2, and half of that time was spent on Siberia. Now this is kind of interesting. So in the recent in an interview I read, it says here that Timesplitters 2 had 23 months development, so not a huge amount of time. By that time, we had a working engine from a release game, so it was enough time to upgrade the tech and add a decent single-player game. And then he goes on to basically say, we spent a full year working on that level, Siberia, of a dam, to get all of the gameplay right, and we spent the second year adding all of the rest of the other levels.
So So it was kind of like their testing grounds, really.
Is that not kind of wild? The half of the game was spent just making the first section.
I thinking about it, though, it kind of makes sense, because I think it's even though it's the first level, it's one of the most... It's got the most going for it, I think.
It does. It's very...
expansive.
You can tell, right, that they spent half their time working on that one level, right?
Yeah, it's...
Because it's so much there. All the levels are good, yeah. No, all the levels are very good, but there is that level, which I think separates it, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, you can tell there's detail in there. And also, the dam itself in that level serves as a homage to GoldenEye as well.
Yeah, yep.
And obviously the dam bit in GoldenEye, so it all kind of swings around, right? Serves as a little nod.
There's a lot of the challenge modes as well that feature on the Siberia map as well, so it kind of makes sense. I feel like, they were saying about they spent most of their time developing and figuring out the game mechanics and stuff on that map. Probably explains why a lot of the challenges are set there, right?
There is quite a few challenges set there for sure.
Using the bricks to smash the windows on that map. And,
well, like I said, you just have a lot of sections, right, that are quite immersive. So you have the outside section with the houses and the security cameras and the windows. You have the inside mine section with the zombies. You have the dam section with the helicopter, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot to that level when you think about it.
Yeah, there is, and I think I like the pacing in that level as well, because you start off, it starts off as basically like a stealth mission, and stealth was just something that kind of wasn't even a thing in the first one.
Like I said, right, we hadn't even comprehended a storyline yet.
Exactly, it was just
learning game mechanics like stealth and all that kind of jazz.
Yeah, so this first level, this kind of like you start off with. That kind of like stealth feel. You've got your silenced pistol, sniper rifle, so on and so forth. Picking off, you can essentially do the first half of the level without being seen if you play it well.
If you're a proper sneaky boy.
Yeah, that's it. And you can eliminate people quietly and so on and so forth. Proper stealth tactics. Then when you get to the mines, that's when shit starts to hit the fan.
The mines.
The mines.
Also, interesting little fact here for you. Did you know TileSplitters 1 and 2 are the only TileSplitters games in the series to have zombies on the first level?
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, TileSplitters 3 broke the mold. Didn't have zombies as the first level.
Yeah, we didn't have zombies, but we did have those crazy feral splitters. So
Yeah, we did have those, I guess. Those splitters kind of make things a bit better, don't they?
Yeah, the fact is the zombies still appear in all of them. So.
Oh, yeah, zombies are still like a...
They're a main draw for the series, aren't they?
They are a trademark of the series. I think that's also what kind of attracted a lot of people to TileSplitters as well, because not just is this some weird kind of time adventure shooting game, they also kind of splice so many other elements into it, don't they? From the past to the far future, sci-fi elements to fantasy elements like zombies and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, and characters from the Aztec ruins, like the stone golems and stuff
mythology and stuff like that, right? Yeah, so it's quite crazy the different kind of aspects they splice into the levels. So obviously, as we said, TileSplitters 2 had an actual story mode, but obviously, it also had the incredible, fantastic arcade mode as well, right?
Oh yeah, which is just a massive improvement from the first one as well.
Oh, it was
all
incredible,
the different
wasn't it?
Game modes that you had in this one. By comparison.
In this one, there were so many ones as well. So here's a few of them. We had obviously Deathmatch and Team Deathmatch, very standard. Capture the Bag and Bag Tag made a return. But you had some awesome new ones like Flame Tag. You had Virus. You had Vampire. Shrink, that was a funny one.
Yeah, Monkey Assistant was a good one as well.
Monkey Assistant was a good one. Gladiator as well.
Yep.
Leech.
Thief as well was another one.
Thief and Leech.
That was basically kill confirmed from Call of Duty, but back in the TileSplitters days.
Assault as well. Assault was always fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I liked Assault. Assault was also really good in number 3 as well, because the map maker in number 3 could make Assault maps, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a big draw to that one.
Yeah, that's it. So, the arcade modes were really good in 2. Like you've mentioned there about the introduction of Flame Tag and Virus mode. I think that was the one that I spent the most time on.
Flame Tag and Virus were big modes, for sure. They were definitely some of the big ones, the funniest ones.
It was just great. Like, obviously, Flame Tag being... one character out of the roster of characters that spawn on the map starts on fire. You have to basically touch someone else to set them on fire. And you win the game by being on fire for the least amount of time over the duration of the level.
What's kind of heartbreaking is TileSplitters 3 never had Flame Tag, did it?
No, Virus made a return.
Virus was there.
Flame Tag was gone. Yeah.
Flame Tag. That's a shame, you know.
Yeah, Virus is obviously like Flame Tag, but one player starts off on fire, and then the goal is to set everyone else on fire. So the last game ends when everybody is on fire. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very sad. I don't know when I got rid of Flame Tag, because I thought Flame Tag was a really strong one, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
especially when other game modes like Vampire came back and Shrink, Thief, those game modes, you know, also good, right? But I wouldn't really attribute them to the sale that Flame Tag had.
Yeah, yeah. Again, you know, all gimmicky, all have their own strengths and weaknesses.
Of course, yeah.
You know, Shrink being the person in last place is the smallest, so yeah. Obviously harder to hit. So that's really funny. Monkey Assistant, I loved. Because
Monkey Assistant was a good one.
Person in last place gets AI monkeys to help them kill other players. That was really fun. Love that.
That's
well
proper good. That is, yeah.
That was well good.
The obviously, just like the first game as well, this game had a wacky host of characters as well. And in this one, we were looking at 126 in total, which is a big jump for the first game.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The character roster is massively inflated. And I think a lot of that's down just to the fact that the levels are longer in the campaign, which introduces you to more antagonists and so on and so forth.
It does,
so
completely.
You have those kind of like, you have more enemies to kind of fill out the campaign roster, but then there's also all of the challenge modes, Arcade League and stuff like that, which we'll go into shortly.
Oh, yes.
Those had their own kind of unique characters that you could be unlocked from those to then play in Arcade as well. So.
And also what was kind of big about his characters, right, as well, is the characters actually had low-key stats, didn't they? I don't think any of the stats really made that much of a big deal, to be honest. But they did have stats, didn't they? That did actually affect the characters.
Some of them were definitely better in certain situations. So like with Virus and Flame Tag, obviously pace to be faster. There were characters that were inherently speedier, like Monkey, for instance.
Yeah.
He has a really high speed stat, and he's actually he has a smaller hitbox just because he's a smaller character.
I think it's one of those games, right, that you never really understood the benefit of that kind of stuff because the game wasn't online.
Right. Yes.
So yeah. Metas never developed, did they? You know, we play with friends, we play together, whatnot, with other people, right? And I just usually pick the character I wanted to play that time, you know, rather than going for like, oh, I'm going to go pick this character because he's faster, or, you know, that kind of thing. But I think if the game was actually fully online back in the day, maybe you would have seen a meta develop here with characters.
You would have seen definite strategies form. And I think, yeah, like the smaller, faster characters would be, they would be the go-to. It's a little bit, I'd liken it to like Battlefront 2 and the like Yoda, right? He's so hard to hit.
He is so hard to hit. Yeah, he's a very small boy.
Yeah, or like any of the, like BB-8 or something like that. I don't like BB-8. I don't like him in Battlefront at all, but he's a small target, so he's quite a good character. Like,
yeah.
In the right hands, he can do a lot of damage just because he's so fucking hard to hit.
Oh, he's such a small boy as well, isn't he?
Yeah, so like Monkey has the same kind of the same kind of thing where like he's quite fast, and you know, if he's on fire, like in the Virus mode, then chances are you ain't going to be able to get away from him because he's just faster than you.
He's coming for you.
Yeah, exactly. He's coming for you, boy.
He's coming for your ass.
So it's like, like some of the stats they are kind of quite negligible when it comes to actual just core gameplay.
They're not incredible. Something I actually didn't like a lot, and I will say this actually about Timesplitters 2, is the fact that it took the character introductions away when you picked them.
Yes, yeah.
I think that was a massive step back, actually, personally. If I'm going to critique anything about Timesplitters 2, I think that is one of the things I didn't like the most, because I think the first one gave the characters so much heart and soul when you selected them and they did their action, yeah, that in number 2 it just felt so weird that they got rid of that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, wholeheartedly
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
It strips back any kind of personality that those characters have. And then it's like, oh, here's some stats to make you feel better. And it's like, well, no, that doesn't make them individual.
Exactly.
It's just the skin now, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, they were a bit more human in the first game. And, you know, I'm very glad to say that that feature does come back in number 3, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
Which is so, so good. Like, I think the number 3 character selection screen is like the peak, the tippy top of like the Timesplitters roster, right?
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Because not only does it look great, it works great, and it brings about the character interest, which is fucking awesome, right? What more do you want?
Yeah, it almost felt like it was a little bit of a play, like with the Slurm Factory when they bring out all new Slurm,
all brand new Slurm, and
then we'll bring back Slurm Classic and make billions.
So a little bit to touch on here before we talk about the Arcade League, the Map Maker also returns in number 2. Awesome.
Yes.
Again,
Map Maker actually very good point about Mapmaker. You could actually build story missions.
That was a big one, wasn't it? Stories on Time Splitters 2, which was a feature that wasn't in the first one. That was the big upgrade for number two, was the fact that you could obviously make, like Zach said, make your own story missions, which is really fucking cool, right? It still used a similar system to Time Splitters 1 in that you had kind of sets you could put down, but it gave the player a lot more control how those were placed, how sections were placed. And also, like I said, because you could make storylines as well, story missions, you could have a lot more control over different things as well, couldn't you? That attributes to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I was saying in the last episode about having the ability to kind of change like AI behavior on the maps and stuff like that. You could set up certain enemies to patrol or to be kind of like, say, if it was a zombie, you could have him like laying on the ground dead, and then like a certain action could trigger him and they could get back up.
How cool is that, right? That's like, you know, that's levels of game design, right? That's just included into this for free in a PlayStation 2 game. You know, actual story-driven cinematic kind of stuff you can do, which is sick, isn't it?
Oh, it's brilliant, yeah.
Yeah, for a PS2 game, right? And even for a PS1 game, the original Mapmaker, I don't remember many, many games of the time that let you do stuff like that, you know? I remember Tony Hawk's with the skate park thing. That was really cool. Maybe with skate parks. But like, there's not many games off the top of my head that I can think of that let you have that level of customization.
No, you know? It's really, really quite comprehensive for its time.
And don't forget, this is a game that was made in 23 months, right? Ridiculous. The first game also wasn't made in that long either, and they managed to get the system in. Crazy, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely crazy for them to innovate that much. And also, in fact, I will mention this now because I regretted to mention it in the first episode, but another fantastic thing that Free Radical designed for the game, which is now almost like a staple in some other games, right? And this was sort of unheard of at the time, was the profile system.
Yes.
The player profile system. So players could have their own accounts on the game, all saved on the same memory card slot, and that would track their stats, track their rewards, track their characters even, and track all sorts of stuff like their control settings as well, right? That's such a big deal. That's something nowadays which is so standard, isn't it? You know? Nowadays you see in most games. Not even that, mate. Fucking Netflix has that, right? You know, like just apps have that in general, and for them to kind of do that, I don't remember any game at the time that did that kind of thing, did that kind of system.
No, that's it. It was just kind of like if you wanted a separate kind of like settings and so on and so forth, you needed another memory card, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. So I think this was a tremendous feat for them to actually pull off successfully, to have that kind of profile system integrated so deeply into the game that you could just hot swap who you want to play as, you know, or make new accounts if you were bored of your old account.
Yeah, really.
Once again, all at a time, right, where online wasn't really a thing. Kind of gave you a bit of an online experience, right?
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Yeah, it was really like, and again, like, I think as a company, they've always been quite forward thinking.
They were definitely ahead of time, right? For sure. Definitely. 100% ahead of time. Like, that's why I'm so interested to see what they're thinking about number four now that they're back in motion again.
Definitely. Yeah.
You know, are they going to take the lessons from the past? Are they going to integrate a lot of new FPS stuff in there? Who knows, man? Because the industry's changed. The industry's changed a lot.
It has, yeah. I think before we step away from characters as well, I just want to talk about a couple of returning kind of favorites from the first one.
Of course, yeah.
So obviously Captain Ash comes back, this time in the Aztec Ruins mission that we
mentioned. He's got a little safari hat on, hasn't he, in this one?
He does, yeah. So he stepped away from his kind of like mummy gimmick now. Yeah, and he's now delving into the Aztec Ruins. So he's got his kind of like his like explorer gear on.
Harry Tipper, big safari hat.
Yeah, he does, yeah. Harry Tipper makes a return, and this is at the point where we start to see him become a little bit more of a secret agent, like a spy, rather than being a detective.
It's like his transition towards like low-key Austin Powers becomes even more realised in this one.
Absolutely, yeah.
Before, yeah, like, I think, jumping off the deep end in number three.
Absolutely, yeah. And I love because his mission, Atom Smasher, is fantastic. And you are introduced to his arch nemesis, Kalos. And Kalos is like a super campy Ernst Blofeld from the Bond films. He's so good.
He does, doesn't he? Because it bleeds that kind of that nostalgia for like old Bond films, right? The same way that Austin Powers does, doesn't it? It's like tongue in cheek on like spy movies.
Yeah, 100%. Like, even to the point where, like, in the cutscene before you start the mission, Harry Tipper's, like, he's, like, strapped down to a table and he's, like, about to be cut in half by a laser beam, right? It's just so... It just absolutely bleeds James Bond.
All they're missing, like, is sharks with laser beams, mate.
Yeah, exactly. That's the only thing that he doesn't have. But he's got, like... hordes of henchmen.
But saying that, bro, what about the cat? What about the robot cat?
Robot cat in three is, robot, yeah, that's great. The fact that that's part of a challenge mode as well is superb. I love that. So yeah, you've got him and Kalos. You've got Gretel makes a return, but this is the Mark II version. And
in my opinion, the best version of Gretel.
The best Gretel.
The best version of Gretel.
Yeah.
Gretel really looks cool, like awesome orange hood.
Yeah.
Gretel looks very like, cool. It's crazy because there was also a Gretel in number three as well.
Yeah.
There's a Gretel MK3 that appears in the third game. But she largely resembles her first game form, only she's wearing normal clothes.
She's got, like, cargo pants and, like, a sweat top on.
Yeah, she's wearing, like, normal clothes. Whereas in number two, they kind of turn her into this weird-looking robot assassin, kind of, like, robot assassin ninja kind of thing. She actually features on the box art for number two as well, the European release box art.
Yeah. Yeah, super cool. We also, Chastity Detroit, she makes a return as well. So she was from the Cyberdead mission in the first one. She returns in Neo Tokyo as the second player's character, second to one of the new characters called Ghost. And they're kind of like, they're like ninja hackers kind of thing. So
the mission Neo Tokyo as well is quite funny because I never realized how broken this mission actually was.
Rage inducing.
Until I watched a speedrun. Speedrunner play this game, and it turns out for that mission you can actually just stand still at the start of the game and not do anything until the guy runs back around again and you can just walk up to him. That's it. Honestly, man, it's mental. I have to send you a link if you've not seen it, but a dude did Games Done Quick, I think a year ago or 2 years ago, but he did Time Splitters 2, and I watched him do it and I was like, what the fuck? He just stands still, basically doesn't do anything, and then eventually the guy just circles back around.
Wow.
In fact, while he's waiting for that to happen, yeah, he puts on a second copy of the game and speeds on the Wild West level, speedrunner in the background. I'll send you a link, man. It's fucking hilarious.
Oh, man.
I was like, dude, that's impressive. What the fuck?
Yeah. Neo Tokyo was always the mission that I just genuinely dreaded the most because...
Mate, when I show you this, you're going to rethink your fucking life choices.
It's tedious because, like, if you cock up in the first like stealth segment part of the level... It's fucked. You've got to start from the beginning again. It's just, it's awful. It's so unforgiving.
I did like the vibe of Neo Tokyo, and also the soundtrack was good as well.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, a good one.
Soundtrack in general, I think, like, every track is a banger on Time Splitters 2.
We were talking about this before, right? There were so many good songs in the Time Splitters 2 soundtrack. Like, number one was great. Number two just blows out of the park. The soundtrack is just absolutely fire.
Yeah, so, and I think three makes a good return to form, but I still don't think it's quite there. I still think two.
No, you are right. Some of the levels in two, I do agree, do have much better music. I'm still on the fence about the intro music, I will admit, but I do think there are some levels in number two that are classic. The music is classic.
Yeah, yeah.
Scrapyard, man. Goes hard.
What I think is really cool as well is in two and three as well, when certain characters don't make a return, but relatives of those characters make a return. Which I think that's really, really cool.
That's really funny, right? Because that plays, doesn't it, on the time traveling trope.
It does. It? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Isn't it the cowboy dude?
Yeah, Elijah Jones. is the great grandfather, I think, of Peekaboo Jones, who's the main character from the mansion level in Time Splitters 1.
Yeah.
So it's really cool how they tie that all in. Mary Beth Casey's sister, Jo Beth Casey, makes her first appearance in Time Splitters 2 as well, but only as an arcade character, not as a campaign character. She then appears in 3. It's the same one, apparently.
Oh, okay.
and it is the developers confirmed as well from Free Radical. They confirmed that Jo Beth is Mary Beth Casey's sister, and they fucked up with the time. So,
it's just a fuck up, bro.
Yeah, it's a cock up. So yeah. Mary Beth is from the 60s, Jo Beth is from the 90s, and they're supposed to be sisters, right? There's a large gap there.
I do remember seeing Free Radical issuing a similar statement when people were talking about the end of Time Splitters 3 and the possibility of another game coming. Yeah. Obviously, you know, spoilers, at the end of the third game, Cortez basically gets rid of the crystals, doesn't he?
Yeah, he basically does a Thanos and destroys the crystals and destroys the splitters in the process of doing that. Yeah.
So because of that, everyone was like, "Well, how's that going to work?" And they were like, "Well, you know, we kind of just didn't really think about that. we would just make another game and we can't." But I think that's where the Time Splitters series shines, right? Because even when it gets its most serious in number three, it's still not really that serious.
Yeah, that's it. I mean? And it's a game series that's never been worried about taking the mick of itself.
Like, exactly.
They are quite happy to laugh at themselves. And when they make a cock up like that, they're just like, they don't try and come up with a smarmy ass answer. They're just like, okay, right. That was genuine oversight, but we can fix it because time travel, that's why.
Well, that's what what we were saying, right? The actual storyline and kind of trying to follow the plot lines and where things fit in, right, is a state anyway in this game. So like little things like that you'd expect to happen, wouldn't you, along the way? Like it'd be shocking if not, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it does. Like, time travel gets quite confusing anyway, right? You've only got to watch the fucking Terminator films, right?
It's fucked that up.
it gets to a point where you're just like, yeah, no, I give up. I can't be bothered to keep track of this now. I've just watched the explosions like a good little robot and hope for the best, right?
So to get yourself some fancy characters, mate, yeah, you not only had to play Challenge Mode, but you also had to play the Arcade League, didn't you?
Yes. Now, Arcade League was a new addition to Time Splitters 2. Didn't feature in the first one, but did make a return in Time Splitters 3 or Future Perfect. So Arcade League challenges, they differed a little bit from Challenge Mode in the sense that it was normally a team-based activity. So a lot of the challenges featured you teaming up with AI characters in order to take on the opposing team. And you had to win under certain conditions. So it might be like, and it was a great way of introducing you to different arcade modes. So like we've mentioned with with the vampire, monkey assistant, gladiator, all of the Arcade League challenges had those kind of different arcade styles fitted into there. So you could almost give them like a trial run to see what it's all about and kind of challenge yourself at the same time as doing so. The challenges and the Arcade League challenges, they had a kind of like a reward system. So you could earn bronze, silver, gold, or platinum trophies, depending on how well you do. Getting a gold normally on a challenge or a set of challenges normally would mean that you'd unlock extras. Just getting a bronze would unlock the next tier. And there were three tiers of difficulty. So there was amateur, honorary, and elite. And they obviously increase with difficulty as time goes on. Just really good fun, to be honest.
I always kind of attribute them to a bit like, almost like an arcade-y story mode, right?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Because you always
went through them in order and you did kind of challenges and there was flavor text and that. It was sort of like, you were done with the story mode and here's this kind of arcade-y twist on a story mode. But also, in a way, it reminded me of modern games and how they have ranked modes online, you know? Because you went up to different leagues, didn't you?
Yeah, definitely.
So that, I think it definitely had that kind of vibe with it as well, you know. Time Splitters, once again, innovation.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was a good way of extending the product's kind of lifespan beyond just the campaign.
And to be honest, I'm going to hit you now with some even more crazy Time Splitters innovation, yeah, in the form of achievements before achievements were a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Arcade Awards, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So if you did particularly well if you're just playing like a TDM or something, you had the most kills, you'd get unlockable accolades and stuff like that, which was really cool.
Now, I have some pretty funny ones here if you want to hear some of the good ones in the game. So yes. In total, there is about 60 of these that appear in the game, including Time Splitters 3 as well, which is kind of crazy to think, right? So this actually provided another kind of form of collectible for players to kind of indulge in, right?
Yeah.
And some of the ones out there, you obviously had like Most Lethal, which was just to kill the most players. The Lemming Award, which was to commit suicide most often. The Insomniac Award, which was quite funny, and that was to play for more than 2 hours after midnight on the system clock. So the system clock would count, and it'd be after midnight on the clock, you'd get that award, which is a bit of a bizarre one. Some of the funnier ones, though. Most Peaceful, finish a match with zero kills. Most Useless, contribute nothing to a capture the bag match. Most Outgunned, use only the worst available weapon in the game or your fists. And finally, the Golden Oldie, which was to play a Time Splitters 1 character 25 times or more.
Oh, very nice.
Which is kind of cool. So yeah, those are kind of nice. And they appear in number 3 as well, very similar names. But some of those are quite interesting. Like, that's kind of stuff you'd attribute now to trophies and achievements, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but absolutely. Yeah.
This game sort of had them internally, just as its own little kind of collectible thing. Like the Insomniac one, play for 2 hours after the system clock hits midnight. That's such a weird one, isn't it? Considering the time. Like, who would have thought to do that, you know? Whenever developers played with the system clock and stuff like that, it was always really cool to see. Like Kojima did in Metal Gear with the Psycho Mantis fight.
Yeah, that was funny. That's really funny.
Where he reads your memory card. Fucking really cool shit, right? That's nice stuff. It's like, it's that weird kind of wall break, isn't it, between them?
Yeah, and it's, again, like we've said many, many times, it's just one of those kind of novelties now that it's lost on the modern console age, isn't it?
So, rather sad, actually, to be fair, but Transmitters 2 has always been dubbed as a critical success from Steve Ellis, the leader of Free Radical, but not a commercial success, especially outside the UK. In fact, it didn't actually sell that much at all. Do you know how many it sold in its lifetime?
No.
2 million copies.
Oh.
That's it. Which is a lot, don't get me wrong, but
yeah.
Think about nowadays, right?
Yeah, you compare it to any of the larger franchises that are about nowadays.
And, right? And not even that, right? Not even that. Like he was saying, like even back during the day, like other shooters that were lower ranked from them, you know, like the very first Call of Duties back in the day, were getting 3 to 5 million sales.
Yeah.
You know, Timesplitters 2, 2 million sales, bro. That's on the much lower end of the scale, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Which is quite sad, really, because it's such a good game. And it really is, I think, a cult classic, isn't it? The whole series is a cult classic because, you know, spoilers, I'm going to drop this again, but Timesplitters 3 also was very similar. Also didn't sell very well globally. So it's rather sad, to be honest, because part of the reason why Timesplitters never continued on was because no one wanted to invest in the game series because they were scared that it wouldn't make its money back.
Yeah, just I can't wrap my head around it personally.
It's very weird, isn't it?
Because maybe we're a little bit biased, right?
Because, yeah, we are totally biased, right? Because we had such enjoyment with the game series, but also, right, I'm not a snob for wanting to play popular games anyway, you know? I've always been one to play the kind of weirder games that maybe people don't necessarily like a lot. Like, I like the Oddworld games, you know? They're some of my favourite series of all time, and those are games that have never really dominated the headlines but have a fantastic pedigree and a real history on console games, gaming and PC gaming, you know? And Timesplitters is definitely the same as Oddworld, for example. It's a game series that has an immense pedigree and has a lot of industry-defining moments, but when it released, it never hit that mainstream. And now we're getting a return to form because, you know, more people have come out the woodwork, haven't they? More fans of the game, because that is what a cult classic is, right? It only gets stronger.
And yeah, and that's the thing. I feel like that's what we got to do as fans is we have to show our love and our appreciation for these games, because if, and like you've said there, like if the industry doesn't think that people will buy it, then they just won't invest in it.
No, they won't. They literally won't. Like at the end of Timesplitters 2, in that same interview, Steve Ellis said that Eidos weren't going to take it up again. They weren't going to pick up a third Timesplitters game. This was after Timesplitters 2 came out. They went and did Second Sight, obviously, and they didn't go with Eidos for that either. They went with Codemasters. So they were kind of searching for a long time on who to publish the third Timesplitters game, which is when EA noticed for Timesplitters 2 they were making the third one and decided to come knocking.
Yeah, which kind of blows my mind, really, because I said to you, didn't I? I think it was after we finished recording the last episode that I had a bit of a what if moment for you.
Oh yeah,
and I'm just
going to propose your what if.
Propose. I'm just spitballing here, right?
Alternate history time.
Imagine if the series had continued to survive. Would it have just been another cash cow in the string of titles for the EA empire to milk?
I 100% think that you'd be looking at a Battle Royale Timesplitters game.
Yeah.
If that had happened. But at the same time, if it still had that nostalgia, that still had that feel, that still had the same vibe as the originals would, I mean, would I still play it? Probably. Because I don't just love the gameplay, I love the style of the games.
Yeah,
you know, I love the nostalgia, obviously, more than anything, because it's just a real hit, right? You know, nostalgia is a huge thing. We want to do an episode about this in the future, talking about remakes and video game remasters, don't we?
Yes.
And I think this is where that kind of comes into play. Remakes and remakes and remasters, the reason they do so well is because people crave nostalgia, don't they? They crave that. They crave that, remembering the better times, you know, the remembering times when times were more simple. Like we said last time, you know, us playing TimeSplitters 1 and TimeSplitters 2 as kids, it was a much simpler time, right? People like having that feeling back. So I think that's the reason why these games do, you know, remakes and remasters do so well. So I don't know if it had still continued, would I have kept playing it? Maybe, you know, I don't know. It's an odd one. It's not one to think about.
I think it would depend, because I think if they had utterly gutted the series and it was a shadow of its former self, I don't know whether I would.
In a way, maybe it's fine that TimeSplitters died when it did, is what you were saying.
Yeah, that's it. Like maybe it going
as
away
as
for
it
a while,
was dying after the third game, it was maybe what it needed.
You know that old adage about absence making the heart grow fonder. I think that we as fans now, we are hankering so badly for a TimeSplitters game now that
exactly
we're just gonna snap it up as soon as it turns up, right? Regardless 100%. Of
when regardless Free Radical of what actually it looks like. Come together and actually get this game out, right? I mean, it's gonna be monumental for any fan, you know, that has followed the series and continued to follow the series for so long, right? It's gonna be unbelievable when it finally does come out, and you know, I'm hoping they do it justice, because I can't wait to play it.
Yeah, but that's it. I hope that it isn't just going to be a one-time drop and they just play on the nostalgia, cash in quickly and move on. Like I hope that's not what it's going to be.
Yeah,
and I want to remain optimistic about the situation, because it's been a long time in the making, right? But we've seen this happen before with stuff like Duke Nukem, right? Duke Nukem Forever.
Oh, good lord.
People waited a long, 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 long time for another Duke Nukem game.
What a fucking shit show that was as well.
And it was an absolute disaster. So I really don't want to be in that position where I'm like, ah, no, what have they done? You know, like I think with all the goodwill in the world, something's going to have to give, right? Something will have to give eventually.
I think they've done the right idea, right, by getting Steve Ellis and that on board. They've already gone back to the roots, right? They're getting OG team members back in. They're getting the band back together, aren't they, basically?
They certainly are,
right?
And
that's what they need to do, because I think that the fans, right, are going to absolutely clamour for this game. They want it to be done right, and they want it to be done by the people that did it originally, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think people would have been necessarily happy if it was handed off to another studio, you know what I mean?
No.
Another show, you know, picked up the TimeSplitters name.
Even with the original team members, you know, we've seen in recent history it doesn't always work out. I mean,
it doesn't,
use Back 4 Blood as a good example as well, right?
Yeah, that's obviously where that divide comes, right? That's when we go into the uncertain territory. Are we going to take the cues from the modern era? Are they going to try and bring back the old style again? You know, what are they going to do?
Yeah,
right.
Because that's ultimately what we got, right? We had the idea, the premise of Left 4 Dead, and it was then modernized to the to the kind of the gameplay that we expect from these days, right, with your loot boxes and so on and so forth, right? And the execution was poor, and it's like with TimeSplitters now, they're in a difficult position where they're going to have to try and maintain as much nostalgia and feel for the old games as possible, but like we said in the last episode, they are going to have to modernize. They have to bring 100%. It into the current day, otherwise it'll collect dust and people will be like, well, this is, you know, this is old. So
this fell off.
Yeah. So it's a tightrope act, and I don't envy the studio, but I'm very, very excited at the prospect of us of getting that, you know.
So to have a bit of a dive into the third game, we spoke about the second game here, let's kind of look at the third game maybe in a bit more of a critical lens, because I think the third game, like I said sort of last time, I think it is the formula perfected. I think it is everything that they have taken up till now and kind of made even better than before, right? Ironically, this is kind of funny. So like we said, TimeSplitters 3 actually featured like a proper story mode, didn't it? A proper, proper mode. Obviously, 2 had their kind of story mode, which was nice, and it was much better than 1, obviously. But 3 was everything more, because there was actual dialogue between characters. There was full-on engaging cutscenes, wasn't there? There was actually a coherent story which ran through the game as well. right?
Yep, you played as one character for the entire game.
And do you know what? This is going to shock you. Do you know who we have to thank for that decision?
Who?
EA. EA wanted Free Radical to shift the focus of TimeSplitters 3 away from multiplayer and to create a deeper single-player experience. You know,
now you're pulling my leg.
Isn't that fucked up? Yeah, this was before. This was, and this is accurate. This was when EA had
coming from the same EA that buried Dead Space because of the multiplayer.
That's
right?
The thing, right? This is how the industry changes. This is how the times change, right? This is EA in the past, and EA in the past were all for big single player games. You know, nowadays, obviously, not just EA but the industry in general has shifted, hasn't it, to more online. More multiplayer games.
Certainly has, yeah.
You know? So it's funny to see that a studio that obviously was, for the longest time, calling for, you know, the end of single-player games, back in the day was actually not only lobbying, but heavily suggesting studios promote that, you know? Which is, it's kind of weird, kind of crazy, right? And you know that, well, TimeSplitters is superb, and the storyline is superb, right? Obviously, its hearts beat strongest, doesn't it, in the multiplayer mode. I think that's what TimeSplitters truly shrines, right?
Yeah.
And sadly, TimeSplitters 2 sold 2 million. TimeSplitters 3 only did 1 million in its entire lifetime sales.
Wow.
Which was such a dip, right? It was such a dip. And that ultimately is, sadly, what kind of ended the franchise, really, because there was just not enough money there at all. Because this was a time, right? This was a time where fucking games were starting to cost a lot to make. A lot to make, right? Remember the OG TimeSplitters, was done on a ridiculously short budget. Remember 500k the first game was done on, right?
Yeah.
This was a time when weak returns would not get you another game. You know, production costs basically around 2005 era of games were spiraling so much, that they were getting up there to where Hollywood is with films. You know, and even nowadays we're even eclipsing with bigger games. We're even eclipsing here films and how much budget is put into films. Which is incredible, you know, and that ultimately was the coffin, the nail in the coffin for the series. That 1 million sales, it just wasn't going to cut it, you know. Once they were done with that, no other studio was like, "Now we can't risk funding it." You know, it's just too much work for not a lot of return, which is such a shame.
But
I think that number three, despite this, is definitely one of the best games in the series because it's got a lot of heart, a lot of soul. I think the multiplayer, even with the focus on single player, it's still there and it's still fucking strong. Yeah,
they definitely borrow, I think, some elements from other games. Like I like in the TimeSplitters 3 multiplayer when you have the announcer, very much it kind of leans into that Halo vibe.
It has a big Halo vibe having the announcer
you
there.
Score a headshot on somebody and he goes, "Open head surgery." It's just good shit like that.
Wasn't it the same voice actor that did Cortez's voice?
Yes, I think it was,
Or very similar, if not the same guy that did
it. I'm pretty sure it is the same guy. I think so.
And I think that really helped sell it, didn't it? Because it gets you hyped when you're playing the game. And obviously this game had even more arcadey kind of modes in it and arcadey things in it, didn't it? It actually had even more characters this time. The total in this game was 150 characters.
Yeah.
Up from 126 in the second one.
They all have their own intros as well.
The intros are back again as well. They all have their own intros, which is awesome. So cool. And there's such a mix as well, isn't there, of characters from all games.
Yeah, and like we were talking about the stats from the previous one, the stats are back, but they've expanded even further on them this time.
Yeah, they kind of changed up a little bit, didn't they, and changed what the classes were.
Certain characters had resistance to fire weapons and electric weapons as well.
Which was a big deal in the game because, you know, you had some which were really heavy towards that side, weren't they? You had the flamethrower, obviously, and you had the electro tool.
Yeah, so like with the the robots were really fire resistant, but really kind of quite susceptible to the electric weapons and stuff like that.
Something that happened here in this game as well, I think that also helped to sell right that TimeSplitters had moved on to like a full story mode, was the fact that the missions were actually named missions now, weren't they?
They were named after
the locations they were in.
It's like a title rather than the location. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So originally it starts off with Time to Split. Boom, you know, that became the trademark, didn't it, for the series after that point?
It did, yeah.
And also because of the hilarious jokes that occur in the third game with Cortez making the reference numerous times.
And it just hits a dull note every time.
Which is hilarious. It's such a funny running joke throughout the game that Cortez makes this joke and no one no one likes it. Everybody hates it. So you start off, obviously, with Time to Split. You then go on to Scotland the Brave, The Russian Connection, The Kalos Express. See, already, right, you're getting different shit, aren't you? And also, a whole different kind of game, isn't it, in this one? Because also, because number two, obviously, had really cool design levels, but number three took it up a notch, right? Like Kalos Express. That's a whole level on a train, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The whole level's like sees you jumping between train carts and going into trains and stuff like that. That's a really kind of cool mission.
It's cool because you have multiple chapters that are set in the same time period as well. Yeah, so it's not like every mission is a separate compartmentalized zone that you go to collect a time crystal, say, for instance, like it is in two. And in the first one, it's every chapter. Like, so you might have like two chapters in the same time period, and that happens in a couple of instances, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Every single one, right, has that difference. So you have the Kalos, you have the Russian Connection, Kalos Express, which happens just after that, doesn't
it? Some of them are like back to back, and then others are split up, aren't they?
Yeah. Mountains of Madness, and you have What Lies Below, which takes place after.
The mansion one is we'll discuss that one in a little bit. That one is
it sort of starts to get a bit more weird towards the end, really, when you have the machine wars and something to crow about, because then you start kind of jumping back and forth a lot because of the story and the plot kind of changes, doesn't it, at that point? Without giving too much away, and also the characters sort of change a bit, don't they, as well, in a way?
They do,
directly, but they sort of do. And also, for a little bit of time, Cortez actually gets a bit of a part, doesn't he, in R110?
Yes.
There is a few missions in a row where R110 is like your backup, but not just your backup in terms of he's a side character. He's actually sort of involved in cutscenes, isn't he, as well?
He is, yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
And it's great as well, because he starts off obviously just as like a robot, you basically reprogram him, becomes your partner for a short period of time, and he's just like a standard robot. And then he gets like... doesn't he get like electrocuted or something like that?
Yeah, he gets basically, Cortez jumps on his back, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And like rips open his like hard drive and like fucks around with it. And then he sort of becomes Cortez's like friend, doesn't he? But he also starts to get a bit mental. Like you remember the gesture he says when you click him in the character's face?
Eat my laser, eat it.
Eat my laser.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. Yeah.
And then because you're fighting other robots as well, and he's like, he's giving them shit like your mama was a trash compactor and stuff like that, right? It's just stupid shit like that.
and also the fucking, we see the character jump again, don't we? Because is there not Mordecai Jones in the Machine Wars?
Yeah, like, Mordecai Jones is the leader of the human resistance in the Machine Wars. So yeah, he is a descendant.
Elijah and Beakman Jones, which is kind of cool.
Correct, yeah.
And also the whole Machine Wars section is basically just Terminator, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's 100% the storyline for Terminator, in a nutshell. Do you have a favourite mission, mate, of Time Splitters 3? One that sticks out to you?
Oh, that's a good question.
The Machine Wars is quite a good one, actually.
I do like the Machine Wars one. There's like a driving section with a tank, and you get to control the Titan, which is really good in that one as well.
It's quite a cool one, isn't it? Yeah.
I think it's called the Goliath, isn't it? The Titan sized robot.
It is. It is.
I think the mansion. I love, as creepy as it is, it's brilliant. Like it's got all of those like commonplace horror tropes in it. You've got zombies, there's ghosts, there's all kinds of shit going on, right? And it just kind of bleeds Resident Evil, it kind of bleeds George A. Romero zombie films.
Oh, 100%, man.
It's just so well, it's really, really well done. It's even got some like exorcism stuff in there as well. And it really goes all the way. It goes all the way with it.
It's so good, isn't it, that one? So I would agree with you for sure, 100%, that the mansion is one of the top ones, right? Because it's creepy, it's dead sinister, it's horror at its peak. Like you said, it's so George A. Romero, and it's also so unsettling as well. Like,
it is, yeah.
Everything about that is unsettling. We spoke a bit about it in the first one towards the end of the episode, but it is a fucking creepy-ass level. The mansion is creepy, the sounds are creepy.
What lies below, which is the lab after, is
even more creepy. Something I did love doing, though, in that one, I'm not going to lie, was the zombies in the containment. You ever those?
Yes, yeah.
You could mess around with the keyboard. The
computer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was fucking class.
You could, set them to explode or set them on fire or... There was even one where, like, there's just a scientist hiding out in the cell. He's like, oh, you got to get me out of here. And you can zombify him if you want to.
You can turn him into a zombie, yeah. Like, that was cool, because that was another thing, right? That made the story missions a bit more engrossing. They put these little sections in, right? These nice little interactive things where you were going around the level, right? Easter eggs, but also kind of fun things to do. These little
you can interact with computer terms.
Because there was a lot of them, not just those. You could do other ones, couldn't you? Other levels, and you could see like voicemails, and you could see like emails and stuff out there, couldn't you, as well?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of like extra lore if you want to go and look for it
I think another really good level I loved was eugenics.
Yeah.
As well. Just because I think it was such change from everything else. Like, you play the first level, because Eugenius Jess is the second part, isn't it, of the first part?
It is,
The first part being breaking and entering. That's a cool level anyway, because
I like Amy Chen as well. Yeah, she's a really good character.
Amy Chen's a really good character. And also it's a nice refreshing sequence, because obviously you just come out of the zombie section, didn't you? And you're like, fuck, you know, that was a bit sinister, you know?
That was heavy.
And now you're in like a futuristic city on the roof. Like, that's really cool. And you kind of go along, and the mission's kind of progressing normally. And then you go under the facility, don't you? And then it starts getting weird again, right?
Yeah, you got mutants and all kinds of stuff like that,
right? Yeah. It starts getting a bit like, whoa, what's this? Like, you know, totally left field. You didn't expect this before. And it's it's a really cool kind of flip up, you know? And also quite creepy as well, because the labs on those sections are quite creepy.
Yeah, it should be said as well, because I mean, we haven't even mentioned the main antagonist of the series yet either, which is a character called Jacob Crow, and he is. And the thing is that the series isn't particularly forthcoming with his link to the Time Splitters.
I think this is also what we're talking about, right? With Free Radical sort of just kind of going along, don't they?
Yeah,
And being like, yeah, you know.
But, yeah, so basically Jacob Crow, he is the kind of the closest and most direct result of the human Time Splitter war. So he's like, with him, he's kind of like the... he's like the Miles Dyson of the story, you know, in Terminator 2, when Miles Dyson, he's reverse engineering the Terminator chip and arm to create technology that makes Skynet come along quicker, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Jacob Crow is like the Miles Dyson of this story, in the sense that by him existing and him furthering his advances towards wanting to gene splice humans with time splitters and stuff, he is the kind of the key to bringing humanity to its knees quicker. So he kind of becomes this natural kind of antagonist, just with his goals and what he can cause.
It's a complete kind of head fuck, isn't it, when you try and sort out a storyline, because Crow comes into this, obviously. You see him at different points during the game, at different ages, in different times. He also interacts with his past self, doesn't he? In previous sections, which also changes his future. So it's like his involvement with the series kind of fucking makes the timeline go even more fucked up, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And the fact that Cortez, at certain points during the story, has to interact with himself in order to get through certain segments. So, and I think this is what you were leading up to with the Eugenius eugenics, right?
Yes,
there's a segment where you have to use wormholes to jump through, and there's like four different versions of Cortez in one room, isn't there?
It's
crazy.
I actually really love the sections where you play the game. So we're going to drop some spoilers here, but it's got to be done for discussion. You obviously go through different points in the game, right? And at certain points, things will happen, things will change, and you won't be directly kind of understand the reason why they happen, do you?
No.
Like in the very, very first level, the mysterious hooded figure?
Yes.
That follows you around on the top? Who is this man, you know? Mm-hmm. When you finally go through in Scotland the Brave, right? And I can't open this door. Psst, the key. You need the key, right?
Yeah.
Cortez drops you a key, but you're Cortez. And it leads to this interesting dynamic where later on in the game, you are the one to go back through, aren't you? And to do that for your past self.
Yeah, it's really clever the way it all ties in.
So you're the one who then goes and gives the key. You're the one who, you know, does all the extra stuff, right? You come back and do it for yourself, don't you?
Yeah, I love it as well, because you've got there's a handler who's talking through the through your earpiece throughout the whole game called Anya. Is it Anya?
It is Anya, yeah.
Or is it Anna?
Anya is I don't know, the name, it's spelled like you could pronounce it either ways, probably. Like,
yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, she's on the earpiece, and she's like, oh no, you got to be careful about wormholes. You might cause like a space time continuum rupture, or you know, you could cause a fracture in reality or whatever. And he's just like, whatever. And he just walks through the wormhole and he's like, there you go, there's the key. And it's just brilliant. Yeah. Like, it's complete wanton disregard for the universe around him.
Yeah. it's ridiculous. And like I said, there's so much to his storyline that kind of just goes off on one. And you're just there like, what is going on? Like, what is going on, right?
And it's just like, just roll with it, man. Just roll with it.
Because also, they also don't really kind of... I feel like this is one that they never really talk about very much. So in the second game, you obviously have Cortez's partner, don't you? Corporal Hart appears as a character as well, doesn't she, in number 3?
Playable character. Yeah, in one of the arcade missions.
One of the arcade missions. But to be honest, right, they never really kind of established the kind of connection between them two properly, I don't believe. Like... They obviously had a good relationship together and stuff like that, and there was a lot behind it. But I guess because of the way the storyline was and the fact that we only really got like that proper storyline in number 3, I think like they could have done a lot more with Corporal Hart's character, you know what I mean?
Definitely, yeah. And you know, it's like they even make a reference in Time Splitters Future Perfect right at the beginning.
One of the
Marines, he comes and finds you, doesn't he? And he's like, so where's Corporal Hart? Like,
yeah, is that Corporal Hart?
Don't say anything. Yeah. Because she obviously doesn't make it back in the second.
No, she dies. Late. She dies.
She die.
She do die.
But like, it is really cool that her
involvement is very off the cuff, right? Because in the second game, she's not going through the portal with you either. She's the one who's holding the time splitters back, isn't she? Where you're in the portal.
Yeah, yeah. She's actually like operating the. Like all the machinery and stuff that makes the time portal work. Yeah. So you can get back.
She ends up like sacrificing herself basically to save you so you can get out with the time crystals, don't they?
It's great. Like,
so
she's a
cool character. I actually really like her design as well, to be fair.
I do like the shocking red hair.
Yeah, she's got really bright red hair. She's got this big kind of metal arm type thing going on, like a respirator. I feel like if they were to ever do some kind of like, I don't know, I guess I don't want to say like, what they're doing with Rewind, because that's just like arcade. If they were to remaster the game and the storyline as well, it would be really cool if they did some kind of splice where Corporal Hart was maybe a bit more involved, you know.
I will if you'll allow me for a moment.
For sure.
Right. With Time Splitters 3 and the way that it ends, if the fourth game is going to follow on directly from the last three games, basically, Cortez resets the timeline, doesn't he?
So he does, yes.
He destroys the crystals, and therefore the war never happens. If the war never happens, then Corporal Hart never dies.
This is true, but it also brings up even more stuff, right? Because it's like, if the time splitters never existed, and time splitters has been stopped, you know, what would have happened to the space-time Marines that he's a part of? Would they even exist? Not really. If they have existed, would Cortez even have joined them, right?
Yeah.
You know, Corporal Hart would have obviously died, which she doesn't have a thingy there anyway. So that's a thingy as well, right?
Or but like, do you think?
What would have happened? It's like without the Terminators, would there have been a resistance? That kind of thing. You
know? Yeah, that's
without the Time Splitters, would there have either been the Time Marines to stop the Time Splitters?
But what I think they will probably do, if they do decide to go down that route, is they'll do a Thanos and he'll walk through the portal and go, like, you know, I'm inevitable, right? The Time Splitters are going to do that, right? They're just going to be like, we're inevitable. We're always going to be here.
Yeah.
So that's the direction I think they'll go down. And I think if Free Radical, as they always do, you know, perfectly on brand with Free Radical, I think that they would be very wise to play on pop culture, like the Marvel films and stuff like that, reference those in their storyline. I think that would be hilarious.
That would be kind of good. To be fair,
they
like,
have
I could
some kind
see
of
them.
Quantum time travel like they do in Marvel in Time Splitters, just to take the piss out of it. I think that would be brilliant.
Yeah. Completely. I could totally see that, to be honest. Not going to lie. I mean, they could also maybe be like, I don't know, you know, obviously the time crystals got destroyed, right? What if there was just like, what if there was one other time crystal out there or something like that? You know?
Yeah.
What if there was just one more and it just had enough power for someone like Crow, like to get back or something, and to just fuck things up again? And start the whole cycle off again, right? But this time with different knowledge, or I don't know, you know, it could be interesting. I guess the fact that it's Time Splitters is about time, they could fucking splice anything in there, couldn't they?
Absolutely, yeah. Like, the thing is, the game doesn't really even need to follow Cortez. We could have another hero.
We could have another hero. Yeah.
You know, it could be anything. Like, I mean, I'd even go for like a game where it's set in an alternate reality and Corporal Hart's the main character. I'd go for that.
That could be quite cool, to be honest. Yeah,
I'd love that. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, bringing them back would be awesome, to be fair. Just bringing them back in general. But I think that would be a nice place to really tie in our conversation with what's going to happen in Timesplitters 4, because as much as I'd like to see it, I don't want them just to do 4 with that awesome multiplayer arcade experience, which is good. I'd love a story mode as well, you know?
Yeah.
I'd love a return to story. I'd love a return to what we had in this game, because like I said, even though it is cheesy and really corny and whatnot, I thought the storyline was really enjoyable. You know, you had a really good time. I had a really good time playing it.
Yeah, that's it. Like, I think with the right marketing, that will solve the issue of the, you know...
Because let's be honest, right? Most first-person shooter games, right? The storylines are never really amazing, are they? You know, there's exceptions, obviously. Halo's got a really good storyline, right? But still, right? FPS games, I don't think they're always the best medium for telling, like, truly engrossing storylines, right? I think that you've obviously got, like, a lot of good ones from, like, the big RPGs and stuff like that. Like I said, there has been a few outliers. Halo, for example. Bioshock, for example. Amazing storyline. Yeah. First-person game. But also, Bioshock... very different to Halo and Timesplitters because it never really had that kind of multiplayer element, did it? You know,
it did in 2.
It did in 2. Really, yeah, I actually
didn't go down so well.
I wasn't going to bring that up because I don't think we need to remember that. I don't think we need to remember that. Although I will admit, I actually did have kind of fun with the Timesplitters with the Bioshock 2 multiplayer mode. It definitely wasn't needed, but at the core, it was a single player game, right? What I'm getting at is both Halo and both Timesplitters were both, you know, very big multiplayer shooter games, weren't they? As well as having storylines.
They were, yeah. And, like, the thing is that, like you were saying about the first-person shooters not being the best medium for storytelling, the first-person perspective is the best medium for storytelling because it's the most immersive.
It is.
The shooter environment does take you out of it.
It's the shooter environment because I believe, Outlast, for example, when we spoke about Outlast, Outlast is an incredible horror game because it is, like, peak first-person terror. But it's not, like, a crazy over-the-top shooting game, is it?
It's not.
It's pure horror experience, right? I feel like I will reword it to like the big kind of, you know, bombastic shooter games. You know, those are a little bit less, I think, storyline kind of heavy, aren't they? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's like you don't play Doom and go, wow, great story.
Yeah, exactly. Even with the latest one, right? I think that's how they should do, actually. That's a good point. I think that's how they should do with storyline for the new Timesplitters. They should do it like Doom 2016 storyline, because Doom 2016 had actually had a pretty good story, but it was never thrown in your face. You could play that game and you could totally just go through it, get to the end and be like, that was a really good shooting game, really good shooting game, and not even comprehend the storyline that had just passed you. It gets a bit more in the second one, in Eternal, which is also really good, by the way. So they found a really good kind of thing. Basically what I'm saying is it works when it's not super serious, right?
Defo.
You know, and I don't think Doom 2016 wasn't very serious, you know, even when the threat of eternal damnation is faced with you, it's still kind of a little bit slapstick in places. I think Timesplitters could totally do that same kind of vibe, couldn't it, with number 4? It could 100%. Be like, it could lean on its slapstickness, which makes the storyline a lot more kind of carefree and a lot more less serious. You're not going into it with any reservations, right? Because imagine if Timesplitters 4 was like, nah, man, we're going to go into it with some really weird, really kind of serious Call of Duty-esque storyline. You know what I mean?
No, it's not going to hit the same note, is it?
Like, imagine that. Imagine it just wouldn't work, would it? What made the OG one so good, and by proxy, like other games like Doom, for example, was that it had serious moments, but it also had fun, tongue-in-cheek slapstick moments, like Cortez doing his time to split line, even right up until the very, you know, end of the game when the potential for the human race to be wiped out is quite high, right? He's still cracking jokes and stuff like that.
Yeah,
in the Harry Tipper one, right? He's still cracking jokes when they need to defuse a nuke. You know, like, it's that level of that level of seriousness, but also, you know, sarcasm, which is nice.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think we kind of skirted over the kind of the UI advances as well,
for sure,
between 2 and 3 as well. Just simple things like having reload animations on the guns, kind of a, you know, a fairly minute thing to change, but a really big deal. The fact that they moved away from the 007 aiming style in favour of the permanent crosshair on the screen.
I'm not going to lie, that was quite a big deal, actually. Yeah, I totally forgot about that until you mentioned
massive
that.
Deal.
But obviously, in the other games, right, the reload animation was, fuck me, it was just
the gun, just ducks off the screen and then it comes back up.
You dropped the gun down, didn't you?
Yeah.
You dropped the gun down. Whereas in Transformers 3, like you said, you had proper, fully reload animations for the first time, which was super cool. And yeah, something we hadn't seen before. And I think that also helps to make the game feel a bit more realistic, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, definitely. You know, like some of the, like the sci-fi handgun, right, is like the first weapon you pick up in the game. And the reload animation for that is great. It's really cool.
I think
it looks
that
like
also,
a staple gun, doesn't it?
I think that also really sets the tone as well, doesn't it, for the game? Because you're like, okay, here we go. You know, that's the first moments of the game, isn't it? When you come out and you walk onto the world, yeah, and you're there in Transformers 3, you pick up the gun, you see how Cortez interacts with it, and you see the reload animations, and you're like, oh yeah, this is an improvement for number 2 already, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
You can already see improvements, right? Which is big.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you really want. That's what you really want about the game as well. You really want that to sit there and be like, yeah, I can see the improvements here, right? You don't want to be looking at a new second game and playing it and being like, oh, this is just like the first one, you know?
Yeah,
there has to be innovation. You can't just make the same game again, right? You have to innovate and you have to go on and try new stuff, right? You have to take these risks. So I think having something like that is so good because it gives you that exposure, doesn't it? To like, oh yeah, here we go. I wonder what else is new, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, and speaking of innovation as well, obviously Mapmaker's come up quite a few times as well.
Mapmaker,
but it was even another jump from 2 to 3.
There is, yeah.
You know, obviously still the ability to you know, to do all the things from the previous installments, but it even had stuff like you could change the skybox on the
maps. Yeah, you really could.
You could add barricades. Vehicles were even a thing in the third one as
They also leaned into obviously giving the player the ability to make maps from the assault game type in arcade, which is really good because that was actually quite a big game type, right? So it was very cool to see that jump into the new one. It's like, okay, now let's give the players the power to control it.
Yeah, and Assault literally plays like Galactic Conquest from the Battlefront games. Where
100%,
you have like phased objectives.
Yeah, you had like sections, didn't you?
Yeah.
And also so you found like the battle maps were genuinely more bigger, weren't they?
They were, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good.
So good. So good. Oh, it's incredible. It's such a good, it's such a good improvement. And like you said, again, they were always pushing the boundary, weren't they, with the game?
Yeah, like there were some great features, like being able to like add barricades and vehicles. Like I said, there's even like the ability like to stack up rooms as well to create like multi-leveled, more diverse environments in the map maker, and like things like slides and the death rooms are quite interesting.
Oh,
as well.
Oh yeah, the death rooms.
That just instantly slay characters upon their entry.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Like,
it's so cool to see that, right? So cool to see that.
Yeah, some really, really insane steps in there. And I really hope that, like, the things that they can do that won't affect, you know, the kind of the modernizing of the game, it's things like bringing the challenge modes back and stuff like that, you know, like bringing back. And having those kind of like you said, those tongue-in-cheek kind of things. Like there's one that always kind of like jumps out for me from Time Splitters 3, and it's one of the challenge modes, and it's like a miscellaneous one, but it's called Cortez Can't Jump.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah.
And I love that because what you basically do is you use your temporal uplink's kinesis ability to throw metal balls through hoops while you're on an elevator. And I love it because it's not only a reference to the fact that you can't jump in the Time Splitters games, like there's no jump function at all.
Nope.
But it's also a reference to the comedy film with Woody Harrelson and Wesley Snipes, White Man Can't Jump.
Yeah.
So it's like a twofer. It's like a two-pronged joke, which I thought was excellent.
It's a very, very, it's a nice little tongue-in-cheek moment, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it's stuff like that. That's what they need to bring back for the new one to make it, to give it the feel of Time Splitters. Mm. If they can do that, it doesn't really matter what they do in terms of like the UI, how the game handles. If they want to throw a sprint function or a jump function, I'm not going to be beat up about that because it's just about modernizing the game.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, I think jumps will be totally fine and sprints will be completely necessary now for sure. Like that's a fact.
It's how you keep the gameplay fast paced, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It has to have that level, but the game can still maintain its classic Timesplitters moments, I think, even with those introductions, for sure. You know,
yeah, definitely. The wild and wacky weapons as well needs to be
the weapons.
They need to return
the weapons, the characters, everything. Right, like all of the crazy monkey characters that appear in number three. Right, like they double down, don't they, on the monkeys number three.
You got
Brains in that one as well.
Brains, the monkey, the zombie monkey.
Brains, the zombie monkey. You got the
We already spoke about RoboChimp.
RoboChimp, yeah. Obviously, a play on fucking RoboCop.
Yeah. Ninja Monkey as well.
Ninja Monkey. I forgot about Ninja Monkey, yeah. Ninja Monkey also a big one. So it's stuff like that, right? Keeping that is just the best and what you really want to do. And once again, like I said, lean into that nostalgia and add those old maps back in. So Timesplitters 3 actually did do this, because Timesplitters 3 featured the Chinese mission map, Mexican mission, and the training ground maps from the original Timesplitters remastered.
Yeah.
You know,
the Chinese restaurant is the only map to be in all three as well, which
it came into all three, which is really good. It's a cool map as well. Yeah. And
yeah, it's a real throwback.
They brought it back and they made them, they made them a lot more kind of high fidelity and stuff like that. The Mexican mission, I think, was a classic one as well.
Yeah. Mexican mission is great. Really awesome. Good soundtrack as well for that one.
Banging soundtrack. I think the map was just really nice as well.
It was. One, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Like the map was just really, really good for characters. Like, it was a really fun map to play on. There was a lot to do. Sniping was really good. There was
multi-tiered as well.
It was multi-tiered, which is really good. It had a cool little bell. If you shot it, it made a sound. That was cool.
Yeah. As well. Just little things like that, right?
Sort of like how the gong in the Chinese level also does that as well.
Yeah.
Little cool little things there. It was always the one I used to pick when I wanted like a quick match, or I wanted just to try a new weapon in a match, you know?
Yes.
I would always learn to Mexican mission, because it was just... Yeah, I just found it so much easier, like, to quickly just like, okay, boot a Mexican mission, right?
I really liked the Vietnam map on Timesplitters Future Perfect.
That was a very good one as well. Yeah, another good.
That was probably the best map to play the assault mode on, because you had like, there were a couple of points in the map where they had like a Vickers machine gun set up, so like you could just jump, because it actually had turrets on it as well, which was great. So you could jump on a turret and just rinse people as they were running across the bridge and stuff like that.
That was fucking lit, man. It was so good. So good.
Very cool.
Another good map in that one as well was Harry Tipper's Club, obviously.
Oh, the nightclub.
Yeah. Was it like the Big Tipper or something like that? Because it had like a neon sign in there. I don't know if it said
something like that. Yeah.
That one had a fucking unbelievably good soundtrack,
and the song for that, Hey DJ, great.
Yeah,
so good.
that was such good. That's the thing, right? There's so many different styles of like music that get incorporated into the series. Yeah, so many different ones. You know, you've got funk, you've got eerie kind of ominous music, you've got futuristic sci-fi, you've got big kind of ballads and orchestral stuff with the Scott and the Brave mission, right?
That's great, yeah.
Right? It's such a crazy mishmash of fucking of kind of visual styles and soundtracks and stuff like that. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. That actually kind of reminds me of the bit when just after you've saved Jungle Queen with Captain Ash, and there's that organ and you can like interact with it and it plays like different tunes in Scotland and the Brave.
Oh,
I love
that.
It's
got a few choices, yeah. Like... Yeah, it's so funny.
And the next one's just like, da-da-da-da-da, but you're playing it on the organ. It's just great. Like, it's just little things like that, just being able to interact with the environment in just like a daft way like that makes a game so much more charming, doesn't it?
So I'm going to award now as well my most fucked up character award in Timesplitters history.
Carrion Carcass.
And that 100% goes to Carrion Carcass. I have seen discourse after looking through the wiki, Timesplitters wiki on this, here are some of the things people say. This thing haunted my nightmares for a week. These things are sickening. This creeped me the hell out, but I still love the detail. And in all fairness, yeah.
So for those who haven't seen it, Carrion Carcass is a cow, but after it's been butchered.
But it's alive.
It's sentient.
So think about that for a second.
And it still moves when you shoot it. It's nightmare fuel. Also on that note as well, you're aware of the deer haunter, yeah?
The deer haunter,
yeah, the kind of the head fixture that comes to life and it has a body behind the wall, right, in the mansion mm-hmm. level.
Yeah.
My missus now, she can't see a wall mounted head now without it creeping her the haunter. Yeah, she just thinks of the deer haunter. Like anytime she sees like the deer heads in, you know, like sometimes you'll go to like certain pubs and they'll have them above like the fireplace or something like that.
Actually, to be fair, I will give a second shout out actually as well to Deadweena.
Deadweena, yeah.
Deadweena, Deer Haunter, and Carrion Carcass were, I think, amongst the most creepiest characters we ever got in Tarsplitters game.
The zombies were great as well, I think.
Zombies were packing heat in the third one, you know. They looked awesome.
They definitely were. And they run as well, which is terrifying.
To be honest, another thing which was actually we didn't really discuss in Tarsplitters 3, we're kind of just rattling off Tarsplitters 3 now, but I think this is pretty cool to get into it. Blood actually was a thing in this game. Proper blood.
Yes.
Yeah. That was obviously something that the original games never had, like technically proper blood. And by that, I mean actual, like, you know, gibbing from characters as well.
Yeah, gibbing and actual, like, blood falls on the floor when you shoot things.
Yeah. So there was like full on gibbing in this game. There was full on blood when you hit someone, that kind of stuff. You know, the original games never had that.
No, they didn't. No.
Which was
and our boy sign. Crispin, he makes a return.
Burn, baby, burn! I loved Crispin. He was a classic one. Loved playing him.
Just a character that's perpetually on fire. Yeah. Like, that's great.
Crispin was awesome. Also, shout out to Undead Priest as well. Loved him as well.
Undead Priest was a good
actually
one,
loved Undead Priest in the third game because he was in the action figure packet, wasn't he?
Yes.
Tarsplitters 2 on it. So when you selected him in the character select screen, he had like a little, he was like an action pack, like action figure blister pack. And above it had like Tarsplitters 2 and the Tarsplitters 2 cover art and like Cortez on the side. But it was like he was a toy from the original game.
I'll tell you what, if they ever wanted to like go back like Legacy and do a like an action figure collection of the Tarsplitters characters, I'd be down for that.
Oh, that would be fucking cool, wouldn't it?
Cash in on the merchandise, my boy.
Well, to be honest, if they are going to plug the new Tarsplitters, you know, a good way to plug it is to make some merch. I would love some statues, mate. I would love some figures. Holy shit, I'd be all over this.
Yeah, t-shirts.
Like a rash, bro. Hats. Like a rash.
Oh, yeah, seriously.
I would be all over it like a rash, mate.
I'd like to quote JonTron now and go, I'll take your entire stock.
I would buy that out in a heartbeat, to be fair.
Yes.
Like I said, if it's not clear from this episode and the first episode, right, these are games that have literally, I think, defined our gaming, haven't they? They've defined how we play games, and I think defined very much how I see games and very much how I define first person shooter games as well.
Yeah, like they definitely, there's a certain bar, isn't there, that 100%. The Tarsplitters series sets.
Yeah.
You know, are they the best first-person shooter games I've ever played? Maybe. Mm. Maybe not. But the fact is that I've enjoyed every moment I've spent on them.
Every single moment, yeah. I can't really think of a time where I haven't played a Tarsplitters game and I've had a bad time, you know?
Yeah.
It's always been a good time. It's always been a fun time. And I think that's what makes this game so special. And that's, yeah, I guess what we kind of want people to do. We want people to go out there maybe and experience these games themselves, you know? It's a bit difficult nowadays, obviously. But if you have an Xbox, you can play the first two and three, can't you?
You play 2 and 3. You get a PS2, you can get all three of them.
If you play a PS2, you can get all of them. And if you get the Tarsplitters 2 Redux mod, which me and Zach were actually discussing before this episode, those guys have actually packaged together the incident we spoke about in the first episode with the Tarsplitters 2 kind of first playable levels being found in Homefront Revolution. And their mod will actually allow you to play just Tarsplitters using that, which is really cool. And they are actually expanding on that as well. They've recently bug fixed things. And they're looking at adding the potential for multiplayer as well, which would be big.
Yeah.
So,
which if we get a real functional online multiplayer for that, like you've got no excuse not to get it. It's super.
If it does. Yeah. I mean, I, for one, now I found out more about this, I, for one, I'm going to put Home for Revolution on my Steam wishlist for the sheer want of playing an official Tarsplitters PC port.
Yes.
I'm so sorry, Home for Revolution, but it's got to be done. It's got to be done.
I'm not sorry.
You are holding on to one of the best games ever, and I'm going to take it from you.
Yeah, because if we can figure out a way to get it to work, and you can play like co-op campaign and stuff like that. Like
now, that would be big, wouldn't it? That would be unbelievably big. That would be a good tie over, I think, until someone either figures out how to get number three on the PC, or we finally get that fourth game. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, somebody needs to get the source code pronto.
I would love number three too. Honestly, if Deep Silver did it, right, that would be a tremendous push for the new game, yeah? If they, in the background, ported TimeSplitters 3 to PC and whacked it up there, yeah? That would immediately start bringing kind of people back into the fold, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't even have to be a fancy, like, what the Rewind guys are doing. Port the game. Port the base game if you have to. Give it some HD upscaling as all. AI upscale for textures. You know, to 1080p, 4K, whatever, because that's sort of what they did in the TimeSplitters 2 remake anyway, so it's been done already.
Yeah.
Do it.
Seriously, yeah. Deep Silver, take my money.
I'll do it. I'm
trying to give you my money here with this.
I would not argue. If they released it and it was identical, the same game, and the graphics were the same, nothing changed other than it ran on normal things, I would fucking buy it in an instant.
Yes.
I would buy multiple copies for people I know. That's how much I love this series.
I agree. You know? I agree.
So, yeah. It's going to be an interesting time. It's going to be an interesting time, but we hope you guys have enjoyed kind of just listening to us discuss about TimeSplitters, because it is truly one of the GOAT games for sure.
It is. And just kind of take solace in the fact that we have this to look forward to, you know, that we've got this. This is a milestone that we're approaching now.
It is, yeah. We have literally come out of the dark times, I think I want to say, right? The times of uncertainty, you know, is we've spoke about some rather sad kind of topics in these two episodes, you know, the fall of Free Radical, how the TimeSplitters games never actually sold a lot, never actually made a lot of money. You know, all that has been the constant for many years. So it's quite crazy to now think that we've actually come out of that tunnel. Free Radical are coming back and we're going to get a new TimeSplitters game after so long. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. That's the thing. I remain cautious, but I am surprisingly, well, not surprisingly, there's nothing surprising about it. I remain optimistic about it, regardless of how cautious I am.
Cautious, but very optimistic.
I'm going to will this thing into existence if I have to.
I am going to pray. I'm going to like bring it in. Like, it's like, cryptids, like the Mothman and that, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, they sort of, the idea of a cryptid like being alive, right? It's, I forget what the term is, it's a special term for it, but it sort of, it becomes like urban legends that they become alive because people give them life.
Yes.
By telling stories of them. They kind of, there is this term for it, but I've completely forgotten the term. They kind of bring them alive by giving stories to them. So if we talk about TimeSplitters 4 happening, it will happen, is what we're saying. We're breathing life into it.
And that's it. If you get the opportunity, talk to people about it. Share it.
Tell your friends. And thank you for listening again, everyone.
Thank you ever so much. And we're looking forward to coming back and speaking to you again soon.
Y'all take care now.
Bye.